This Christmas week on Art on the Air features Indiana ceramic artist Dick Lehman, who will be featured as the 2026 For the Love of Art Fair honored artist. And a follow-up interview with photographer Tom Duty about his recent time in war-torn Ukraine. Our spotlights on Joseph Beat's newest book, Lost Treasures of Indiana.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight, or returning to us, is Joseph Beat. Of course, most of you who are familiar with the NWI Times, he's a reporter there, takes care of everything from business and just about any topic up. But he's also an author. He's got a new book out I think this is the fifth book, called Lost Treasures of Indiana. Previously, he's done like Lost East Chicago in the Harbor. One of his first ones was 100 Things to Do in Gary and Northwest Indiana Before You Die, and many, many others. Joseph, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for another fascinating book. It's just amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yes, yeah. The Reedy Press, one of my publishers, had asked me to write this one as part of a series they're doing on Lost Treasures. There's also like a Lost Treasures of St. Louis, where they're from, a Lost Treasures of Delaware, Lost Treasures of Omaha, and so forth. It's part of a national series. But the previous books I've written for them have kind of been travelogue with the interspersed with a bit of history. This one is more historical in nature. It's kind of focusing on bygone places throughout the state and all facets, from, you know, bygone museums to department stores to restaurants to natural landmarks like the Hoosier Slide in Michigan City that had once been a 200-foot-tall sand dune, one of the state's top tourist attractions, and ended up getting hauled away by the ball company in Muncie to make ball jars. But it really looks at a number of different, it looks at not only but the bygone places that kind of really define the state, like places people fondly remember, like the Star Plaza Theater, or, you know, some of the restaurants, or the Souser's Kitty Land in Cherryville, some of the restaurants people might fondly remember, Strongbow Inn in Valpo, or the Country Lounge in Hobart, or the music places like the DC Country Junction in Lowell, which was known for, you know, its line dancing, and they would have the, they even had like zoo animals outside and everything. But it also kind of looks at the contributions Hoosiers have made to the country. One of the guiding quotes was from Kurt Vonnegut about wherever I go, I always find a Hoosier doing something important there. And it looks at, like, you know, some of the significant art movements we've had in the Hoosier state, the Brown County Artist Colony, the Golden Age of Indiana Literature, all the great artists to emerge from the Heron Art Institute in Indianapolis, but a lot of the, not only the bygone places, but just Indiana's contributions to the world, from the early automakers that helped, competed with Detroit in kind of the early fledgling days of the auto industry and came up with a lot of the innovations that helped drive it, like the rearview mirror, rubber tires, things of that nature were all pioneered here in the Hoosier State. People don't like realize like how much we've contributed, everything from Wonder Bread to the Gatling gun to tomato juice was invented in French Lick, Indiana.
Push button car buttons. That's pretty cool. The radio buttons, right?
Oh, yes, push absolutely.
Car radio buttons. That was cool. You know what I also like is that you add, you do add the history to it, though. Like, it was the first time I knew that Merrill's High Decker that place was the inspiration for Wolfman Jack's booth in American Graffiti. That was very interesting.
Oh yeah, that's an incredible one too, because like that was, I lived in Indianapolis for a while. I drove by there by the fairgrounds quite frequently, and you just didn't realize, you know, fully the history of some of those places where Dick Sumner ended up being in the DJ Hall of Fame, very prominent DJ in the Boston area for many years. He got his start there on WIBC doing like a rock program for teeny boppers during the 1950s that was like by far the most popular of the era. But he was in a booth at the top of this drive-in. The kids would go to the drive-in, they would eat, you know, the burgers and fries and shakes, but they would also be listening to his radio show live. He would have bands there. The audience would come in and they'd take part in the interviews. They'd ask questions of the bands. They did it. They're famous for doing a thing where they would ask them, the audience, to honk if they wanted to keep playing the record or honk if they wanted to get rid of it.
Yeah,
there was a case
it.
Where one of the patrons hated the record to the point if he pulled out a gun and shot the vinyl record to smithereens, like right there in the parking lot. And it's just like there's such a rich history of all these places from, you know, Lake Michigan down to the Ohio River. It has a lot of Indianapolis stuff, but also a lot of Northwest Indiana stuff since I'm from here.
I was going to say this is a little bit departure because most of your things have been focused in Northwest Indiana, and this has taken you throughout the state of Indiana a lot more. So it's a little bit more difficult to research because you had to probably get out of the local area here to do that.
It was in a sense, but I did live and work as a reporter down in Indianapolis, and I went to college in Bloomington, and I pretty much traveled all over the Hoosier State. I've been to museums, and I've been to pretty much every significant city or town in the state. I've been to all the museums. I've traveled and studied Indiana history for years, but this one was a little bit more intensive because I had to talk to historical societies and libraries all across the state to make sure I wasn't, both to collect some of the excellent historical photos that are in the book, but also to make sure I wasn't omitting too many like prominent places like Tomlinson Hall or the Pembroke Arcade in Indianapolis. I wanted to make sure that if somebody would say bygone landmark in like Muncie or Anderson or whatever, that it was definitely included.
What's your next project? I mean, it seems like you're cranking out a book almost every year or something about like that. Do you have your sights on something else that you have coming down the tubes?
Oh, I've been asked to write Lost Crown Point by the History Press. That most likely will be my next one. I have a file of ideas, though, future books I'd like to write on, you know, local history in Northwest Indiana, Chicagoland, the state. It's just a subject that endlessly fascinates me. Yes, but this book was a real treasure to write. A lot of it is very personal. I was inspired by places like when they asked me to write it, it immediately jumped out, being from kind of the Gary Metro, where you had a lot of landmarks that were abandoned, like VJ Records that first put out the Beatles, to the auditorium where the Jackson 5 first competed in the talent show. But one place that particularly meant a lot to me was the Town Theater in Highland, where they had the intermissions with the cake and coffee and the very eccentric owners. And I just, it's a treasure that's like forever gone. And I really want to remember places like that.
Well, we'd like to thank you for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight. The new book is The Lost Treasures of All of Indiana by Joseph S. Peet, and it's available probably at every bookstore. We're doing a whole bunch of book signings I know I've been seeing on Facebook and such. So thank you very much for coming on the show and sharing your new book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow.
This is Karen Matavia with It's Just Serendipity, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Dick Lehman to Art on the Air. Dick is a multi-award-winning ceramic artist based in Indiana. He is known in his field for enhancements of several different firing techniques, the longwood fire, side fire, oni-fired, and sagar-fired. These have yielded dramatic-looking pottery pieces, some of which reside in ceramic galleries and museums in the United States and elsewhere. His work has been featured on the cover of Ceramics Monthly multiple times, and he has had 34 articles published in that magazine, plus articles in 11 other international periodicals. He will be next appearing at the For Love of Art Fair in South Bend, Indiana on February 7th and 8th of 2026 as the featured artist. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Dick. Very nice seeing you again.
Well, nice to be here. Thank you.
And it's really nice meeting you. Well, Dick, one of our things our audience always wants to know about is our guests and kind of, I say, their origin story. So how did you get from where you were to where you are now? Tell us all about Dick.
Well, thanks for asking. I got a late start, you might say. My first introduction to clay was actually in college. I twisted the arm of a friend of mine, Bob Smoker, who's a potter, asked him if he would teach me to throw. He took me to his back porch where he and his brother, Howard, had built a kick wheel and showed me where he hid the keys so I could get on the back porch and practice when he wasn't there. I enjoyed that enough that the first opportunity that I had in college, when an elective space came past, I took a clay class, and that was my start, and I really had a passion for it. However, I didn't change my major. In college, I had a religion major next to interdisciplinary major, which was, I suppose, another way of saying, I don't know what I want to major in. The religion major had the most electives in it. And I think that's one of the reasons I took it, although I did have kind of a leaning towards some sort of a pastoral vocation. But I obviously did not do that.
So as a child, I mean, we dug in the yard and found clay. Did you have any of those experiences? What was childhood like? And was ceramics offered in high school and elementary school like it is now?
To answer the second question, yes, it was offered in high school, but not prior to that. I was involved in music, and so I took a pass on the art classes other than music. I was in the band and orchestra, the jazz band, and I didn't have very many of those play in the yard experiences. I look back and I wonder, how did I miss all that? It just wasn't a part of my life until I was a freshman in college. And then I just came to love it. I squeezed as many of the clay classes into my academic schedule as I could. And when I graduated, I built a little wood-fueled kiln, and I took a 10x16 chicken house that had been pulled behind a tractor from one farm to another, going over some tree stumps that they didn't see in the tall grass, and broke out all the floor joists like bing, 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 bing. So I looked at that thing, thought it was just a glorious piece of architecture, and asked my friend if I could fix it up and use it. Of course, he saw a sucker coming from a mile away. And said, fix it up, use it as much as you want. But that was my first studio. It was just 10 by 16 feet, small space.
Oh my gosh.
So you have graduated college and you built this chicken coop studio. And, you know, I read in your biography that you kind of produced what you, I guess you would call it commercial pieces or things like that early on to pay the bills. But tell us about that process before you kind of moved into some of your more artistic pottery work. But I mean, you know, I'm not saying that the early stuff is not artistic, but I mean, it was much more reproducible type of things.
Right. Functional, utilitarian, replication work. I continued as a hobbyist for a number of years while I worked in administration. I learned some valuable skills about budgeting and planning, which I think probably made a huge difference in my success as a potter over the years. But at a point in 1981, I decided that I'd like to try to pursue full-time. And I made what I guess would be called a production studio. And from the start, it was a space where people could come in, see the finished work, and see the making process. That is to say, come into the studio, look around, chat with me. I didn't necessarily have to get up to welcome them. And through the whole 30 years of my clay career as a retail clay artist, I maintained that open studio. And over the course of years, after initially working alone, I hired one and then two. And then over the course of the years, about 50 young apprentices, students who came to work with me, a dozen of whom have now gone on to their own full-time clay careers. And during those years, I was located at the old bag factory. And through 2010, we made a reproduction line of about 100 different products in 12 different glazes. And so we had a stable of glazes, a production line of pottery. But I always, from the beginning, saved some time for development work. So your question, Larry, about when did I start that? I guess it was a part of it all the time. When I was in college, I thought my vocation was going to have a sabbatical, that I was going to either be a preacher or a teacher or a in the helping profession. Back in, you know, the 80s and 90s, all of those professions had sabbaticals, whether they were 3 months every few years or a whole year every seven. I got to moaning one day about why I didn't work for someone who had the far-sighted financial intelligence to plan and pay for a sabbatical. And of course, there was a long pause, and I realized that was me. If I was going to have one of those, I needed to plan it myself. So in a nutshell, I worked with what I would call a sabbatical mentality. Every year, I prepaid 15% of my time. I structured the overhead structure and the profit structure in the business and the employees so that not only me, but they also could have sabbaticals during the course of the year. And whether that 15% of time was a day every 2 weeks in the studio or 3 weeks in Japan or 2 months teaching at Arizona State University, those sabbaticals were sprinkled throughout my entire professional life. And during that time, I knew, since it was paid for in advance, I didn't have to make anything that produced an income. And that gave me the freedom to try new things and to develop. And I think it's where the Sager firing came from, the triple glazing, the Oni glazing, the American Raku, the crystal unglazed porcelain. Time with those disciplines came as a result of having set aside time to do them, to try new things.
You know, I want to know, Dick, did you take to wheel throwing right away?
Right away.
Wow.
And in fact, I would suppose it was several decades into my career before I actually did any hand building at all, apart from the hand building that was a part of the first two classes that I took. I remember my first big hand building process was to build a full-size clay saddle. And I did all the tooling on it, and I made about a 2-foot-tall pedestal, put a Windsor rocker mechanism inside, and created a clay saddle that functioned as an adult swivel rocker.
Oh, my gosh.
I also, influenced by my professor, Marvin Bartel, who just passed away this last year, made a rocking chair. That was all thrown parts. So those were some of those times that I set aside to pursue new things.
Did you, do you still have the saddle?
The saddle and the rocking chair are both at the Hahn Museum in Lafayette, Indiana.
So as you were planning your sabbaticals, did you always know that it was going to be Japan?
Well, Japan was just one of many. But like many people of my age, I'm 73 now, you know, after World War II and the GI Bill became available to ex-GIs, a lot of the colleges and community colleges in America created clay programs. And there was just a flood of people trying to learn from those old traditions. Three important Japanese people came to America and taught workshops at colleges and universities and kind of opened their secrets. And here, all these American GIs who had just come back from fighting the Japanese were now sitting at the knees of the Japanese learning an old tradition. I think it's a beautiful kind of a story. And like many in my age group, I felt that I had to make that pilgrimage to the ceramics Mecca, which was Japan, and Moscow specifically. So, yeah, that was a part of it. And once I was there, I developed relationships that gave me reasons to keep going back.
Is that where the Oni firing came
yes.
from? Or because yours is it's very exquisite and not like other Oni fire things I've seen. So I'm.
Well, when I was visiting Robert Yellen, who's a ceramic arts, an American ceramic arts seller. He's an American living in Japan, has been there for long years, has a Japanese family. In his library, I found a book by Tsukigata Nahiko, who wrote a book called Oni Shino. And Oni in Japanese can be translated as demon or devil, but also it can equally well be translated excessive, extra, a little bit over the top.
Yeah, very extreme.
And I didn't buy that book then, but those images that I saw that day in that gallery niggled around in my head until 3 years later, I sent Robert a note and said, "You don't happen to have that text, do you?" He did, and sent it to me. Now, the pieces I got back or saw in that book were not as I remembered them. And I think that's the beauty. My teacher, Mr. Shihoken Zaki, he talked about chasing the image. When he would see something he really liked, he would study it really hard. And then he said, I think hyperbole, he would set it aside for 1 year and not to think about it for 1 year. Well, you know, I think that's hyperbole. But the point is, he took it in. He did what he called chasing the image, meant remembering and bringing to it his own heart and soul and spirit, and then ended up making something different. But I think that kind of describes my pattern. When I'm making what I'm calling Oni, I'm really making exaggerated and exciting and over the top pieces. Mr. Tsukigata would never recognize his influence on me because my works don't look like his, but the spirit of his work, I think, is what's given my life, that work life in my own pursuits.
Sure. You're interpreting it through yourself.
You know, on your website, I see that you have a lot of writings that are available that you can download. And so
that's right.
Tell us a little bit about some of those. You know, obviously you're sharing your work, and a second part of that question is then obviously with the techniques that you have mastered, you obviously should have classes. If you haven't, I would imagine you should, but tell us about those written works and that.
Yeah. Thanks for asking that. I got through my third year of grad school. And I was studying theology at the time, and there was a common understanding among the faculty and me that I was no writer. I struggled and struggled. And I just came out of that experience knowing that I was not a writer. Then when I started making pots, and especially when I planned that sabbatical for myself, I thought, you know, I wonder if someone else would benefit from this story as well. And I, with much fear and trepidation, I submitted an article to Ceramics Monthly about how to plan a potter's sabbatical. The editor of Ceramics Monthly magazine was Bill Hunt. And within 2 months of my submitting that first article, he came back to me and said, "Say, would you mind having a go at this particular writing assignment?" And I did. He published it. And then I had this amazing experience of discovering that I had, at least in clay, a writer's voice. And it was a more personal voice. It wasn't an academic voice. It was a narrative. It was a storytelling voice. And that voice led to, I guess, overall in excess of 50 articles in those publications. It also led, as you surmise, Larry, to teaching workshops at colleges and universities and regional potters guilds, planning in-studio mentorships where I would meet with one or two people, talk about where they were in their career, and then plan some time around helping them focus on what their future looked like. mostly those people were at, I would say, critical stages in their career where they were thinking about changing direction or wondering what was next. And so it was a real privilege being kind of invited into that space and to walk with them as they found their way to what was next.
I read quite a bit of the Japanese stories that you had about teaching and sort of, I guess we would label it unteaching now, according to that. And just an aside, you know, Ceramic Monthly is such a wonderful magazine, and I do read the articles, not just look at the pictures.
Thanks very much. Yeah, as writers, we don't get a lot of feedback. I think I can speak for others, or I can certainly say I didn't get a lot of feedback. So it's nice to hear that from you. Thanks.
So someone wants to take up ceramics as maybe new or just had like a cursory touching to it. Tell us the process by which you would teach them. What do you start them with? How do you, how do you do that with a new student?
Well, I never really had new students, Larry. I only worked with people who had some experience. So when it came to people starting, I would recommend Fire Arts in South Bend or the South Bend Century Center or Goshen's Clay Artist Guild. There's a place to get started from the very beginning. Just like some people never teach kindergarten and only teach secondary ed, I was a little bit like that. It just seemed like my skill base and my teaching skills were geared toward people who had some experience but had some questions. And so all of my teaching was really offered to people who brought a depth of experience to the process to begin with. But if someone wanted to get started there, you know, in this region, there are three strong teaching areas, as I mentioned a moment ago.
So I actually have a question on some of the challenges and whether it of Sagar and Oni firing. Did that take decades to perfect to where you are now? Because especially like, and is it, and are the terms Raku and Sagar, are they interchangeable? Because I know a lot of the materials that are used in it are very similar, but it doesn't seem quite the same.
That's a really good perceptive question. The firing range in Sagar firing and Raku firing are very much the same, 18 to 2100 degrees. But they're really quite different. My movement to Sagar firing really came in an accident of Raku firing. I invited a Canadian potter to visit me for a weekend. We brought 50, 60 pots, and our promise to each other was that we were going to finish firing, Raku firing all those pots no matter what. Well, tempt fate, right? The no matter what came in the form of a tornado that touched down very near us. And I had my largest pot of the day just out of the kiln into the smoking chamber, and the tornado touched down about a mile away, and the resulting strong winds blew the cover about a half and a block down the street, blew the pot down a hill, rolling through wet grasses until it came to rest against the fence posts with grasses around it. Phil went after the barrel. I grabbed the gloves and the pot, recovered it, and we literally sat on the cover, which was a large metal trash can, and just got wet, weathered the storm until it passed. But when we opened that and looked at the pot, the wet grasses were recorded as images on the pot. And I started, there was a pot still in the kiln, heating up. It hadn't blown away. It was too heavy for that. And I went immediately down to the riverbank, picked some sumac, put it on top of the sawdust, put the pot on top of it. And I had sort of discovered a printing process. But, it's one thing to have that happen a couple times. It's another thing to do it somewhat regularly. And I'd say it took at least 2 years of work until I was making Sagar-fired pots that regularly had images. And then I would say still 30 or 40% were really what I would call good images. The same is the case with Oni. Because I'm using 10 glazes in pouring, dipping, and spraying, and brushing, and trailing, keeping that many glazes on a pot before going into the firing is really a trick. And that's been the big challenge, trying to keep those glazes on. I would say another thing about the Oni glazing, and it's what people who, for the love of art, they're going to be seeing that because that's what I'm bringing. I'll just say out loud that I'm loving those pots. I think they're the best pots I've ever made. But I think 5 years ago, I would not have been able to appreciate them. My visual literacy has had to grow to incorporate these things that I keep discovering. So for people who see Oni for the first time, they might say, oh, what went wrong with that? But I would encourage them to take a closer look and say, oh my goodness, how did all that beauty get packed into that little package? Let me look more closely at that. Let me see if my own visual literacy can enlarge just a little bit as well. It's a big ask.
Well, and the way you create the vessel itself is not a typical way to look at it. So it would only enhance the Oni because it has so many interesting crevices and play. It can play on on the vessel.
Yeah, the vessels are highly altered. And I try to think of them as figures that are dancing in space.
Yeah.
So if you go looking at the pieces, trying to see these figures dancing in space, all decorated like a flamenco dancer twirling a beautiful dress. That's what you'll find.
You know, Dick, we're in our final moments here. I want to give you a chance to tell us about how people can find your work online, how to reach out to you, and of course, you will be at the Honored Artist at the For the Love of Art Fair February 7th and 8th, so people at the South Bend Center, they can see your work. But tell us about anything else you have coming up and those kind of websites and things.
Yeah, thanks. The website is just my name, dicklehman.com, and you can find there a range of about 30 different kind of vessels. And just as of today, I've self-published a 100-page book on the Oni glaze process. And
oh.
So the book just hit the website this morning. So that's available there. Beyond that, I'm at a time in my life when I'm somewhat slowing, Larry. So the number of exhibitions, the number of workshops and the like that I participate in is diminishing. And I'm finding that part of my responsibility as a person who's approaching a retirement age is to step back, make some space for others, and trying to be as supportive as I possibly can.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and your art journey. Dick Lehman will be the 2026 For the Love of Art Fair Honored Artist. That's February 7th and 8th, South Bend Century Center. DickLehman.com, and we'll have a link on our website with his picture. Dick, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your art. And
been a pleasure to chat with you, too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was completely fascinating. I appreciate it.
This is Janet Davies, formerly of ABC7 and now the Dunes Arts Foundation, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome back Tom Duty to Art on the Air. Tom appeared recently on November 28th of 2025. This is to continue our conversation about his trip to the Ukraine, to see the war with a day-to-day view of the lives of the people who continue to live and work as air raid sirens and bombs are part of their daily life. Thank you for joining us again, Tom. Aloha and welcome. It's nice seeing you.
Thanks, Esther.
Yeah, Tom, we're glad to have you back. I know we didn't get a chance to really finish your story because you had such a storied life anyway, and that was really a wonderful interview. But we wanted, especially, this is a recent thing, you're going to Ukraine and Eastern Europe, and we want to give you a chance to talk about that. So, you know, I'll just kind of kick it off by letting you start. First of all, what motivated you to go there in the first place?
Well, I went to Ukraine as a Chicago photographer to document something that most Americans never see, which is the daily life of Ukrainians as they're living through an act of war. As a photographer also, you know, my goal wasn't the explosions or the front lines. It was faces, streets, rituals, mornings. I wanted to tell the story of ordinary people and how they're surviving there.
So when you decide to do this, what are your first steps? How do you make this trip happen?
You know, Esther, I don't have a lot of experience in doing this. I'm a pretty seasoned world traveler, but I've never structured a trip for photojournalism or documentation or anything like that. And you know, as we had discussed before. It's like I'm not an agenda guy. I kind of run and speak from the heart. And you know, I find that when I try and overplan, that I find myself in too much rigidity. So I kept it fairly open. I did a lot of research. This was the seed of the idea came about 2 years ago, shortly after Ukraine was invaded by Russia. And it was simply an inspiration that that's something that I would like to experience. I had a lot of curiosity about it. So I started working the logistics right before my 70th birthday at the end of September. I just felt like I wanted to do something that would see in the decade with good energy and a new adventure. So I started checking out the ways I would get there, how I would hook up with a fixer when I get there. A fixer is a prominent component of any trip like this, where you're going into a war zone or anything where there's any threat or the need for navigation with authorities or what have you. And, you know, originally I was going to fly into Warsaw and I was going to take a quick train, a 12-hour overnight train to Kyiv. And then they started bombing the rail system. So that turned into a flight into Warsaw, then a flight into Moldova. And Moldova's right next to Romania. And then a 13-hour bus ride into Kyiv, which was an experience. And I've been on a lot of buses. I've been on, you know, this is first, second world. And I've been on a lot of third world buses. But this was 13 hours, no recliner. That's all. And I was the only American on there. It was, and when I handed my passport into the authorities, when they came on the bus and they collect everybody's papers, they just looked at me. And the one guy looked at me and he just kind of chuckled and laughed. And he was like, wow. And I was like, uh-oh, what am I in for here? And, you know, but everybody I met there was very pleased to see me. They have very strong thoughts about the administration and the way that Ukraine has been treated. But as far as individual Americans, you know, there's really a close bond there. And they were really welcoming. And I think they felt really good that someone had made the journey there to listen to their story and to capture what they were doing in photography, capture their lives.
So was there anybody that you met on the bus that was instrumental once you got to Kyiv?
No. It was me and about 100 babushkas. It was mostly older ladies that were traveling that had been outside of Kyiv. I don't know why they'd leave, but I was just kind of an item of curiosity, and they kind of doted on me, and a couple of them gave me pieces of chocolate. And, you know, it was, I didn't have a lot of communication there. And, you know, as I think I said earlier, I don't speak a word of Russian or Ukrainian. So, you know, I was that guy that, you know, I was a stranger in a strange land.
I'm curious about something. This is a little more of the logistics of it, and being a photographer myself, carrying your equipment, how difficult was that? You can't take a whole lot, or just tell us a little bit about the logistics there, especially for our photographer listeners.
Yeah, well, I usually shoot a Fuji medium format when I'm doing architecture, or architecture to me has broadened into basically anything in the built environment. You know, as a rule, I don't shoot people. I have shot people, but I really like the discipline of architecture, and I've self-educated a lot about the different schools of architecture. But that wasn't going to work. You know, the autofocus is, you know, worth nothing. You know, my Fuji lives on a tripod with a 17-millimeter lens, and, you know, that's the only way I shoot it. So I'd been a Nikon shooter in the past, and I missed Nikon, you know, the ergonomics, and, you know, it's a real good carry around. So I went out, and after some research, I bought a Z6, new mirrorless, which is very small compared to the big D bodies that I was accustomed to. And I got it has specific Z lenses. So I got a 24 to 200, I'm sorry, a 24 to 120, a 85 that stops down to 1.8, and a little 20 millimeter that was a 2.8, just, you know, a good walk around lens. Right. And I bought a bag. I bought a sling bag. I normally carry a backpack with, you know, my equipment and incidentals and backup and stuff. And I bought this little sling bag, and it worked really well. I was able to carry all three lenses in it, you know, one on the camera and, you know, two adjacent. And I also made the decision to bring my tripod, which it was, I was, you know, it's carbon fiber, but, you know, it's still a, it's a 7 foot tripod. And I have a big, I don't use a ball. I use an architectural head on it. So that weighs about 5 pounds. And I'm thinking about luggage and my 42 pound limit. And I'm like, oh, there's, you know, there's 12% of it. But I was really glad I did, particularly because of some of the stuff that I captured at Babyn Yar, where I did some night shooting and twilight. And I really was very glad that I brought it. It was certainly worthwhile.
So stepping off the bus in Kyiv, what situation did you observe in like day-to-day interactions? And when you got off that bus, what did you do, not having any contacts, or did you have the fixer at that point?
No, I did not. And I had met up with an artist, Valeria, via just on the web and, you know, talking back and forth on WhatsApp. She had done a show at Marlene Krigowski's Gag Gallery. Mm. So Marlene connected me with her. She's a prominent artist in Kyiv. We never did manage to get together. She fell ill for a while, but got off the bus, looked around, and I got a Bolt. Bolt is the Uber in Kyiv and Eastern Europe in general. And I headed to my Airbnb. And my Airbnb was in it was great in the pictures. In the entrance, it was very Soviet 1968 vibe. It was unattractive, but comfortable. And I figured it had really thick walls too, so that was definitely a plus. But yeah, I arrived in Kyiv, and you know, I mean, there's nothing more exciting than arriving in a foreign city and having absolutely no relationship to the geography or what you're going to see next, particularly as a photographer, to be able to, every corner I turned, there was something new and something interesting. So I got myself situated. I got a good meal. And people are going about their everyday lives. You would not know in Ukraine that there is a war going on. And there may have been a missile strike the night before, a ballistic missile strike, which is like the real deal. People are going to work and going to school and, you know, walking the streets, hitting the cafes. It's interesting, though. It's when nightfall comes, it's a whole different story. The streets.
What is the curfew?
Well, there isn't one. Well, I guess there was one, but I didn't know about it. I was never one much for curfews. So, you know, I kept walking around, but there was nothing to do. I went out to get a late meal. And the first night I got there, there had been a blackout, scheduled blackout, rolling blackout between 5 and 9 p.m. So I ate before 9, but got hungry again, and I went out about 11 o'clock, and I'm like, oh, there's got to be, you know, late, you know, restaurant or, you know, even bar or something that's got some food. There was nothing. It was dead. There was not a single car on the streets. There was nothing. The stillness was just really strange. And, you know, without any power, it's dark. And that night I got home. I walked around for about an hour and went back to my Airbnb, and I went to bed, and I got blown out of bed at like 2 o'clock in the morning. There was a ballistic missile strike that I still don't know where they hit, but it was about 10 missiles that hit. And it was like nothing I've ever really felt. It's this deep concussion that's high frequency, while at the same time, you know, coming from deep in the earth. These things create, you know, 30 meter craters when they hit and take out apartment buildings. And, you know, I laid in bed and I just listened to it. And I'm like, wow, this is what people are experiencing here. I got up the next morning. I waited until stuff opened at about 9 or I think 10 o'clock, even coffee shops. I found a little coffee shop that had a generator, so I was able to get a cup of coffee. But I started walking around, I started shooting, and people just teamed out starting at about 8:30, and the streets that had been deserted just suddenly came to life. And it was, I wouldn't say somber, but, you know, it was very businesslike. It was, you know, it was a night after a missile strike, but people still got up and they went to work and they did their thing. And within about a couple of hours, you know, it would be indiscernible from any European city on a weekday and, you know, everything that was going on. But that's, I use the example as a Chicagoan that friends of mine asked me, you know, what was it like? What was, you know, those missiles? And I said, imagine if Michigan Avenue, River North, and Skokie got hit by ballistic missiles last night. People were killed, buildings were blown up, and the power is out, and you don't know when it's going to come back on. I mean, that's Kyiv on Thursday night.
Wow, on a daily basis. You're listening to our guest today on Art in the Air, Tom Duty. He's talking about his trip to Ukraine, and you're listening on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
You know, we've seen the images where a missile hits a building, and then the next day, like you say, the children are two houses away from that going to school, you know, in rubble. So with that feeling of what is safe one moment might not be safe the next, how does that influence your day?
I have to say, I was in such an observational mode. The thing that separates me from the people there and where I could never really identify was I was getting out of that in 10 days. Right. I was going to be gone. They are there indefinitely, and they are in the fight of their life. You know, they know what's coming from previous experience when the Russians went into Borodianka and Irpin and Bucha. They know what's coming. It's rape, pillage, and burn. And it is something that I think they'll fight to the very last at. That's I'm watching what's going on between Washington and Ukraine, and it's, you know, it's somewhat maddening, but that's a political issue. Their strength, humor, pragmatism, their ability to live fully in the face of danger are just really lessons in resilience. And, you know, I don't know if it's a 70-year-old thing or if it's, you know, incidents that, you know, I had a near-death experience in a shooting about 5 years ago, but I began to examine more of a narrative of mortality and surviving. And I was drawn, I think that's one of the other things that I was drawn to in Ukraine. I found it very interesting that these people were in this fight, and it's literally a fight for survival. And they, you know, they maintain and they carry on. You know, my photos, if you what you've seen of them, they're not about sadness. They're about continuity. They're about resilience and survival.
You know, I watched this video on this woman in the Ukraine, and she said something, you know, really striking. She said, "We are fighting for democracy, but not just for the Ukraine, for everyone." And it's, you know, that, I mean, talk about resilience. Just,
I was in a cafe, and a gentleman about 30, 35 years old overheard me speaking English, and he walked up to me and he goes, "Hi, where are you from?" And I'm like, "Oh, hi." And, you know, we chatted, and he invited me to sit down with him. And he said, "I'm a teacher." And after we talked a little bit more about why I was in Ukraine, what I was doing, he said, "My school's right around the corner. Would you like to come?" And I said, "I'd love to." And I went around the corner with them, and I ended up spending the afternoon there. They had assembled about 50 teachers from all over Ukraine for a thought leadership conference on how to teach democracy and civil leadership to kids. Oh. It was starting in grammar school. And it was quite interesting to watch. They were very dynamic. They were very into it. They valued, you know, the threat of losing democracy for them is a very, very tangible threat. And, you know, that was an introduction to me also to what the kids are doing. Everybody is a part of the resistance there. Everybody is fighting. Kids that are in eighth grade, freshman year of high school are learning how to build drones. And they have different groups that are assembling different drone components. I went downstairs in the kindergarten that was destroyed in Borodianka. That's where the Banksy mural is. And there were women weaving camouflage netting against the wall. The wall was just filled with camouflage netting. And, you know, it was really something to see. But speaking of Borodianka was the city that was occupied for 30 days. And one of the photos that I got that really touched me was of Ludmilla, who had lived through that. Women in her 60s, maybe 70s, who I met her in one of the memorial graveyards to the defenders of Borodianka. And she sweeps the graves every day. That's what she does now. That's all she does now. And she had lived through the 30 days of occupation there. And she told me stories that, you know, would just, you know.
Anything you can share?
Bring tears to your eyes. Oh, she talked about people, you know, the Russians came in and there were Ring doorbells were still on. They thought they were operating with anonymity. And there's all this Ring doorbell footage of them kicking people's doors in, pulling them out of their house and executing them in the streets. She told me stories of, you know, rape, of abuse of elders, an apartment building that had been hit by a missile, and there were 9 people, Ukrainians, trapped in the basement. And for sport, the Russians watched them die there. They watched them starve to death. And, you know, she was, you know, quite a woman. But that's what she does now in memory and to honor the fallen. I heard quite a few stories like that.
So maybe you've answered this in a way, but what is something that we should know about the Ukraine from your experiences? Maybe something that wasn't widely reported?
There's so much.
I
think what you said about this being a war, not only for Ukraine, but this is about Europe. And this is, you know, this is a global issue that could have incredibly serious consequences for people here, for people in the larger Western cities of Europe, you know, the globe. I think what happens there, you know, is going to be key to, you know, whether or not the United States is seen as an entity that will support its allies and can be trusted. Whether we will take the moral high ground or whether somebody will cut a deal with a politician and throw people under the bus. Those are some of the issues that I took away and that, you know, I remain passionate about. I keep my, I have the app that warns you of an air raid. An air raid siren goes off. I have it on my iPhone and a couple of hours later, they tell you to seek shelter. And a couple of hours later, when it clears, they said, air raid is cleared. May the force be with you. And I just love that. But I have it on my phone and it goes off 3 or 4 nights a week. I'll be sitting.
This frightening experience you talked about all the bombs going off. So obviously the your app went off for that. What do they say exactly where the bombs have hit or the missiles have hit?
They don't, because of strategic concerns. They don't want to let, you know, Russia vector in on areas that they've been successful or unsuccessful with. I didn't have the app then, and my walls were too thick and I was too high to hear the air raid sirens. So I just heard the boom, boom, boom. That was my notification that Kyiv was once again under attack.
Well, we only have about 30 seconds left. I'll give you a chance to tell how people can find you online. I know you are both Facebook and on the web and everything like that. And just real quickly, tell us that.
I've been posting a lot of my images on Facebook. I am Tom Doody at Facebook. It's Facebook/TomDoody, TomDoody. My email, if people care to reach out, is TomDoody@me.com. And the website is TomDoody.com. So it's fairly easy to remember. I can be found quite easily.
Well, we appreciate you coming back on to share this part of the story after we got the full story up to Ukraine and let us know what's going on there. That's Tom Doody, photographer. And of course, if you go to our other interview, you find out all the other things that he's done in life. Thank you for coming back and sharing this part of your journey to the Ukraine. And I think it's something that's in the forefront of, or should be in the forefront of all our minds in the United States.
Larry, Esther, thank you for having me back. And it was really a pleasure to be with you again.
Yeah, thank you for making these images available, Tom.
Absolutely. A pleasure.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.